You're listening to the Reversing Climate Change podcast by the team at Nori, the carbon removal marketplace. This is a show about the innovators and entrepreneurs developing solutions to climate change.
Hello and welcome to the Reversing Climate Change podcast with Nori. I'm Ross Kenyon. I'm one of the co-founders of Nori and the creative editor there. And we are a carbon removal marketplace based in Seattle. Did I already say that, Siobhan? Did I say that twice?
Nope, this is the first time. You're alerting our listeners.
That's Siobhan Montoya Lavender from Thanks a Ton and Nori's meme crew. Hey, Shiv.
Hey, everybody. All right. Apologies to our wonderful guest, Sampo Tukiainen, who's calling in with us from Finland today. And he is the CEO of CFIX. And he's going to be talking to us today about first generation and second generation direct air capture, which is a topic I want to sink my teeth into because I think I might be stuck in first gen. And I might be stuck with all the preconceived notions I have about first-gen DAC and what it means and what it's going to look like. And so I'm excited to hear about what the future is going to look like. Let's be forward-facing here.
I don't want to, even before we start that, Sampo, I want to poke at that because do people even like that? I imagine if you're a quote-unquote first-gen DAC supplier, you're probably like, because it's inherently pejorative, right? It's framing them as the old way, the old guard, they're out of touch. They're doing technology that's inappropriately scaled. So is this even a model that you like using? Or I guess if you're second gen, you probably do like it.
Well, I always have to have some edge, to get people out on the fences. But it's not about that. And obviously the whole space and the whole industry is so young and it's moving so fast that people are not like ready for second generation at this.
You're gonna hate the third gen when they come and they leapfrog you. You're gonna be shaking your fist, get off my lawn.
And we haven't really even seen what the first gen can do. So but I guess it's a marketing term, but also it's a real term in the sense that I think second generation is often when you've come across. You've solved and come gotten around some of the early stage and first generation problems, I think we have, and in a lot of areas, so I think it's justified.
I think our listeners are pretty familiar with the term direct air capture, but just briefly summarize, what does it mean to be a direct air capture method? What does that entail?
Well, direct air capture means that you are removing CO2 or capturing it from ambient air, which is, it's a kind of a dilute solution or a mixture. And typically DAC is seen as just the removal component. But I think in the kind of, second generation, we're going to see that, you can actually integrate storage with the direct air capture component. So that's one of the things that sets us apart from first gen, because it actually comes with integrated storage.
Okay.
Is that necessary? Yeah, is that necessary for it to be second generation? Is it mostly about co-locating removal and storage? Is that the main differentiator between first and second gen?
No, I kind of touched it a little early, but
let's do it now. It's time.
yeah. Well, I guess direct air capture, typically it just produces a gas of CO2, and then you have to couple it with some sort of a storage solution like Carbfix or 44.01 or something like that. Here too, it's kind of coupled with the storage solution, but basically, I don't want to go like too deep into to the kind of stuff that is proprietary, because we haven't filed for IPR yet, but I can talk in on a broad level. And basically you have a process, and it's what we do is similar to Capture 6 and Ipcarbon and a lot of companies that build on a chloralkali process and splitting salt effectively, but this is not an open cycle process in the sense that we're not constantly taking in new salt and splitting that and then let's say dump the alkaline component into the ocean or in the desert somewhere, or and then the acid has to be neutralized somehow and or disposed of. So this is basically we're basically killing two birds with one stone, and the same process, that is, used to capture the carbon dioxide from the air, is used to dissolve magnesium out of rock, that is then combined, in this process. And the product is a crystalline magnesium carbonate. And the difference about this is that the reaction is instantaneous. So it happens, at the plant immediately. And it's very easy to verify and record and also trace the material. Plus, I think the business model is a little more flexible in the sense that we're not just because the plant is actually putting out a physical product. So for a 1 million ton plant per annum, say for the sake of argument, you put about 2 million tons of magnesium carbonate a year, which half of the mass is carbon dioxide. So you have a kind of a more diversified business model. You're not just dependent on selling CDR to the quite few buyers that are actually in the game at the moment, like that we all know, like Shopify and Microsoft and Stripe or Frontier. And so
let's do this. Wait, let me interrupt. Let's do a mental, like a verbal whiteboard. So if I was going to be taught like what DAC is, what its history has been and where it's going. So like the DAC, the first column on the left here of our verbal whiteboard would be direct air capture. They're the machines we've all seen, right? We've all seen pictures of these turbine-like machines that are sucking in air. We know they're going through some sort of, then it's touching on a sorbent. And then it's being stored, I assume temporarily at most facilities, prior to a more permanent storage, which would be injection underground, or perhaps it's being utilized, so it's going into materials. So am I correct in thinking that's kind of the DAC as we all know it, like the original DAC is saying, we're gonna suck it out with these turbines, we're gonna store it, and then we're gonna inject it or use it. And so that DAC in my mind is still just getting off the ground. Would you say that's correct? Like we're seeing, obviously Climeworks is the OG in the industry. And now we have Carbon Capture with their new Project Bison coming out. So is that all kind of the DAC as we know it? And then what would separate second generation DAC? Is it this coupling? Is it the idea of storing on site? Illustrate that a little bit for us.
Well, yeah, all of those things. I'm trying to hold them all in my head. I'm not going into names or specific processes, but let's say when you talk about sorbent, for example, and the sorbent is a big thing of the whole equation, because you might have to make the sorbent, synthetically, and it might take a lot of energy, and it might actually have bioavailable nitrogen in it. And if you were to deploy something like that at a gigaton scale, then you would inevitably leach a massive amount of nitrogen into the environment, for example, which is already a big problem because of eutrophication. And then amine-based sorbents, for example, they are, you have to make them synthetically, and they are one of the most energy intensive chemicals out there today. So I think, alkaline and earth alkaline metals clearly are an interesting option there. But at the same time, being what I like to call myself a seasoned process engineer, or, having been involved there for a long time, I wouldn't typically want to have a process with, let's say if I can avoid it, to have too much solid material handling, for example, because solid material handling is something that A, is expensive, requires a lot of investment, takes a lot of hardware, it's prone to failure. It's typically, if you look at a biomass plant, for example, then the materials handling is typically where you get the hiccups. So there are a lot of things you can do better. I would like to say that this process that we're doing doesn't have a single moving part. I mean, let alone the turbine or the propeller at the top of the structure. And of course, here, when you're talking about something like this, you have two things. You have the core process, and then you have the concept that you build around that core process and how you couple it, with the environment, for example. And I think, one of the challenges with first gen direct air capture and, challenges is that it's consuming a lot of resources. It takes a lot of energy, electricity, thermal energy. It takes a lot of water and chemicals. So And it doesn't.
That is the strike against DAC that people always bring up. I think that's the most common argument against DAC is it's energy intensive. And so talk to us in terms of scale. So like if that's like the kind of typical scale of energy consumption, what are you looking at for second gen in terms of energy? Like just compare, and doesn't have to be an exact, you know, wattage, but in terms of scale.
Well, we do some things, you know, we recycle the energy internally in this process. So, you know, like, you know, but it's still, it does take a lot of energy. I would say it takes, depending on how much energy you recycle internally, some of the hydrogen that the electrolyzers put out, you would be looking at 13 to 2200 kilowatt hours per ton of CO2 removed. But that does include the storage component. So, you know, you save a lot in the, you know, compressing and, you know, pipelines and, or, you know, ships or cooling, you know, whatever you do down the line, or injection, you might have to inject it, you know, against a substantially high pressure, you know, much higher than the CO2 pressure itself. But what I wanted to say, you know, the other thing that sets apart and it's been kind of used as a club against DAC is that it's kind of, you know, isn't really tangible or something that people can see, and you know, it doesn't really offer anything to the local community. Let's say that if you build one of these massive plants and you're pretty much gonna have them in tens of thousands of cities or villages or the countryside. So there should be something tangible and a benefit that, you know, you know, that the local population or the society gets from that. And I think, you know, DAC can have co-benefits. And if you look at our process, for example, water is one thing. Instead of using water, we're actually condensing a lot of water because we control the relative humidity and temperature, and the temperature differences between, you know, different flows and the air coming in. So then instead of drying up, we're actually condensing a lot of water. The source of that water is seawater, and we're evaporating some of that and then condensing it back. So there's a small river coming out of that plant. And actually, you know, again, if you look at the million tons per annum plant, that would be about 1600 tons or cubic meters of water every hour coming out of that plant. So it's actually, it's a small stream that you can row in a boat, you know, basically.
That would be salt water desalinized, and then leaving the facility in a stream of fresh water that could then be available for use.
Yeah. It's distilled water that has been evaporated from seawater and then condensed in the contactor. You know, once again, this is a direct air capture plant, so it does have a contactor where you bring the sorbent into contact with the air. But the air that reaches the contactor is very humid, and the contactor is cooled, it's ice cold. So, you know, all that humidity condenses into the contactor. And you're actually able to harvest that as you know, for drinking or irrigation. And the other thing, you know, when I'm talking about the concept that we're building around the actual technology is, you know, obviously solar is the kind of most scalable form of energy, and the kind of large scale plants are based on solar. Initially, you can do it anywhere where you have low carbon electricity, and there's not a shortage of it. Like in Finland right today, we have negatively priced energy, which is nice. And it's been negatively priced for a couple of days now. So that's very nice. But
even during daytime hours, it's negatively priced?
Yeah, in the last few days, it has been. So, which is, you know, nice, because I paid $1,000, you know, per kilowatt hour, something like that, per megawatt hour last winter and last spring, a year ago. It was just crazy, you know. Yeah, what I was going to say is that the other thing is this magnesium carbonate. So if you're in the desert, let's say somewhere, and these plants would be built in the desert, so there's not a lot of market nearby, necessarily big cities where you want to haul this kind of cheap bulk product. So the magnesium carbonate is actually, you know, when you take it out, it's like little rocks, and you can make pellets out of it, for example.
Or will you clink it for us? I heard on LinkedIn your post, you clinking, so that our listeners can hear.
Yeah, it does make
sense. It has a satisfying sound.
It does have this kind of a glass-like sound or sound like a surround. Now my laptop is all covered with the carbonate.
I didn't even hear anything. So you just got it dirty for no reason.
Yeah. Sorry. I'll record it for you. And I'll
add it in post.
Yeah.
Like a Himalayan singing bowl here for us. Yeah.
It's like really crystallized, it is like, you know, kind of a solid you know, structure, and you know, you, that's when it starts to have that sound like that. It's interesting.
Talk to me about building with it, not to get ahead. But so we have, we're talking about co-benefits, second gen DAC. We have the potential of, listen up, Californians, where water is scarce and salt water is abundant. We have the potential of, you know, having this stream of fresh water coming out of the plant. You mentioned on your website that this is something that you can build with. That this is a material that could be used as a building additive.
Yeah. You can press it into bricks as it is, and it doesn't need a binder. And it has a hardness that's comparable to limestone. So on a Mohs scale, it's 3 to 4. So it's limestone is, you know, if you visit European cities, then and most of the old cities are built out of limestone. It's a very good material. I mean, it's easy to carve and cut and, you know, size, but this is different. You know, you have the same hardness. It's bright white, you know, so if you build something out of that in a high, you know, in a desert area, then, you know, it's kind of, you know, good thermally because it reflects a lot of the solar energy back. And yeah, you can use it in a lot of ways. You can use it to build houses or roads and or coral reefs. You know, you don't just want to dump it in the ocean. You want to make bricks out of it and then dump a pile of bricks on which the corals can you know, start building on. So, but it's the question of whether there's a market or not. And it's a cheap bulk product. And I have to go back a little bit because I was talking about the more diverse business model, you know, that we have. And you know, instead of selling just the cork or the CO2 removal certificate to the software companies and internet you know, companies and others, we wouldn't so we're actually, this is more diverse. You can actually sell it as carbon negative. Like I used to be in biochar at Carbofex, and you know, when we were selling biochar, typically you would sell the cork separately from the physical product, and then you would tell the buyer of the carbon that they cannot make any carbon negativity claims or you know, that this is, you know, reduces.
There's using no carbon. Double counting. Yeah,
exactly. So, but we had some clients that wanted the, you know, to kind of buy the carbon negative product so that we would staple the certificates into the backs, you know, figuratively speaking. And magnesium carbonate is similar sort of thing. It doesn't, you know, quite have, is not as intense as biochar, you know, with 3, you know, kilograms per kilogram of CO2 equivalent. I mean, 1 kilogram of biochar had 3 kilograms of CO2 equivalent. So magnesium carbonate only has about 53% of CO2, but it's, okay, it's carbon negative. And, you know, we don't need to sell the cork. We can just sell it as a carbon negative filler or a carbon negative, you know, construction material. Fillers are used in a lot of different industrial products, and limestone is typically, you know, and silica and carbon black and things like that are, you know, typically fillers. So the point is that, you know, companies are able to make carbon negative or carbon neutral products, you know, once they kind of recycle as much as possible and all their energy is renewable, but there's still a little bit of carbon footprint left. The only thing you can do is you can use a carbon negative component to kind of, you know, offset the carbon footprint. And we can do that. So it's not just the CDR market. It's also the industrial product market and the kind of filler use. So it's more diverse.
I have lots of questions, but Ross, it looks like you want to get one in.
I also just want to tell you to stay in your lane. If DAC starts having co-benefits, what's going to happen to everyone else, man? Can you just back off? And just
that's what I was going to say. I was going to say, how could you make DAC unstoppable? Give it co-benefits.
Yeah, no, it has to be. And for people to buy into it and, you know, not have the not in my backyard attitude, then it's got to have, you know, something good. And you know, this concept, you know, it's solar powered. So around the plant, which is by the sea on the desert, you're going to have a big array of solar panels, probably like 500 hectares of them, you know, several hundreds of acres, 1,000 acres, at least. So you're actually going to be able to grow food and stuff under the panels because it just provides a little bit of shade. These are sodium telluride panels. So they're basically thin film and most of the light gets through. So instead of, you know, making the land, you know, useless, you actually, you know, make it arable in a way. And then, you know, the last thing is that, you know, you're going to build these plants carbon negative from scratch. So once again, you know, by using carbon negative materials like biochar. And if we go into the DAC side, you know, the contactor, once again, you know, when you're moving massive amounts of air, you want to have passive, systems or low velocities and laminar flows, which means that, there's no turbulence. So in effect, you want to have an easy breathing system. It's like sucking, when you're trying to breathe through a straw, you're exchanging the same amount of air, but you're doing a lot of work because, there's a small opening. So you have to make all the passages big so that, the flow can, flow easily. And that means that they're going to be big. That's the downside of it. So these structures are going to be huge. And just to put it into perspective, a 1 megaton plant is going to have a diameter of 630 meters. And the circumference of 2 kilometers, and the contactor, frontal area where the air flows into the contactor, the dimensions are going to be 2 kilometers by 10 meters. So it's a massive structure, and you're going to have plates on which your contact solution, your sorbent, is flowing, and then the air is flowing between those plates, and you're hoping that it's going to react with your sorbent. So, these are mega structures, and it means that there's going to be about 400,000 tons of material, recycled plastic and biochar needed, to make those contactor plates. But the good thing is that you're already carbon negative when you start, and you can probably sell some certificates already when you're building it.
You got it all figured out. I thought the future of direct air capture was going to be modular. This is the future that somehow I had internalized at some point. And the fact that there's going to be even more colossal structures built than previously is potentially unexpected to the listeners as well as to myself. Is that still on the table, or does just the economy of scale work way better than the modular approach? I know there's intersections between these two paradigms, but I think you know what I'm getting at.
Yeah, I think it's going to be modular, but it's still going to be huge.
And, yeah, there you go.
Huge and lots of them, in other words.
Yeah. Well, I mean, here too, I'm thinking about what is the kind of trajectory, or how do we go from, being in a lab and making a few handfuls of that product, to making, 2 million tons of it a year. And it goes up, in steps. First, you're doing something that does a kilogram an hour, then it's a ton per day. And then you're probably looking at 2,000 tons a year. And then you go to a module, which might be like 10,000 tons a year. And then you prove out the module. And then if that module is already big enough, and you're kind of reaping some of the economies of scale with that, then you can just stack them stack them. And until you
get your... I'm curious, because this does sound, when you frame it that way, kind of in this year by year process, it sounds achievable. But when you describe this massive facility where we're going to have solar panels and crops growing under them and outflows of fresh water, it sounds very utopian. But what are the big hurdles you're already thinking they're going to come up against? Is it just policy based? Is it just acceptance and understanding of the process? What are the big hurdles?
Well, I try to work around all the hurdles, as far as possible. And, one of them getting around is the storage component, and, or let's say that if you have a hydrochloric acid disposal problem, then one of the hurdles is you're talking about disposing waste, and waste sounds bad to people. And that normally gets them up on the barricades. So it's better if you can make a product of some sort, and nobody has anything against making products, especially if they're carbon negative and sustainable and all that. So, sorry, I lost my train of thought there.
That's okay. So you're talking about building around the hurdles and making
something
that people do want. It sounds so geographically like there's going to be a big plot of land here. And what do you think would be, so I used to work in major utility developments for Caltrans, for PG&E, and a lot of these, facilities we would build take a lot of land. And I was always out there doing the environmental component, right? And so if you want to build a new transmission line or whatnot, you're taking up new space. And on the one hand, you're like, oh, this is in the Southern California desert. There's nothing there. Obviously, we know that not to be entirely the case. There's quite a bit there. And so what would the impact be of doing this truly at scale? Are there enough sufficient siting locations within desert ecosystems that also are, I assume they have to be somewhat adjacent to the actual sea so that they can have not too far of transmission of salt water? Am I incorrect in assuming that?
Well, probably in most cases, you do have rock salt formations and that sort of thing, salt domes everywhere too. So you could be tapping into those. But then again, if you want to do ocean alkalinity enhancement, then yeah, you'd have to be by the sea, one way or
another. Wait a minute, you'd be doing DAC and you'd have outflows of fresh water and you'd be doing ocean alkalinity enhancement?
No, I just, if you asked that, wouldn't one, if they use salt, they need to proximity to the ocean, but we don't need proximity to the ocean because of the salt, because we don't, it's a closed loop. So we're using the same salt over and over again and we're breaking it down and then, starting all over again. But if you're in the desert and you're solar powered, then you need to be by the sea because of the cooling and the fresh water, the water management or the water balance. But if you're in a cooler climate, then basically what you really need is a cooling source, and you need to be able to create a large enough temperature difference in your system so that you actually get condensation. So it doesn't always have to be a water producing system. It could be as long as it doesn't dry up, but making one of these plants acceptable, you kind of got to have the social benefits or the benefits for the local people. And I think, it sounds utopian, but I prefer utopian over dystopian. I just see a lot of things, come together, and we just have to put the first one together. So I think people will be inspired and they want to replicate that. And going to scale, I think it's easier, in this case, you only need 1,000 plants, that are 630 meters in diameter, plus the solar arrays, around that. So it's not, space or land that is constricting the thing. I think it's more like, when you have more project, like with biochar, you would have to build 100,000 plants probably to reach the gigaton capacity. So how are you going to finance all of those and the kind of time and energy that goes into those projects, just developing those projects is enormous. So I think a million tons in, 10 years down the line is going to be your module, and then some places you might see several million tons in a plant if you have a good location, and there's plenty of coastal deserts in the world, and where the land is cheap, there's very little people. If there are people, then they are kind of stricken by drought and climate change, and they need a break basically. So this plant could offer one.
Seems like we've talked about this in a previous show, but it seems like the Arabian Peninsula is probably a prime candidate for something like this. There's water. They're going to lose out on oil and gas pretty soon, or at some point they will. This might be one of those replacement industries that could be quite beneficial. Maybe turn someone who might otherwise dig their heels into an ally of the future of carbon removal.
Yeah, there's like, in South America, there's Atacama. And then you have the Namibian coastal desert. You have, all the Algeria and Morocco is really dry, and the Mediterranean is really dry all over, Australia, India, and Arabian Peninsula in particular is, enormous solar potential. And we've seen some really cheap solar power come from that region. It's like some of the contracts are 0.9 cents per kilowatt hour. And for new large-scale solar.
Have you been following the news about fusion that's come out in the last month or so?
I've been keeping an active eye on fusion for 20 years, and I'm
all is it now the time, though?
Well, yeah, I'd love it, just bring it, and, we'll put it to use. And I doubt it's going to be cheap initially, but yeah, I welcome it, I'd love to see fusion, and I would do fusion. I'd be in fusion myself if I, wasn't doing this.
How would fusion change the location of DAC 2.0, or would it impact it at all?
Well, it just means that you're not kind of tied to high solar potential areas. So you could basically build it anywhere in the cooler or darker climates, like, in the Nordics and,
What's the footprint? Just curiously, I'm as somebody who hasn't been following the fusion discussion, what's the footprint?
Of fusion power plants?
Yeah.
I think they're comparable to fission plants at this point. I know of a few different, new fusion processes, but I'm not going to be able to comment on I think one of the arguments for nuclear is that, it has a small footprint.
We're going to have to do a show on this at some point. Shiv, there's just too much stuff happening. And I'm already seeing the gears turning both inside at Nori. I've seen it elsewhere too, of linking up, high energy intensity carbon removal that is currently not LCA worthy, but if it's abundant and cheap, clean energy, like with fusion, then maybe that changes the equation on some of these things. Curve it and we just use it all up doing silly things. That's also possible.
Yeah. No, I've been playing with those thoughts for a long time that what if we had, abundant, cheap, clean energy, that you wouldn't have to feel bad about using, and you could just, it wouldn't be a limitation,
Then, I love having someone who's at the top of their field like this, having them on, and then ask them the equivalent of like being stoned on your freshman dorm couch, being like, what if abundant energy costs nothing? We save the world. Love being that guy / hate it, but it's apparently what I did.
Siobhan, yeah, no. There's nothing wrong with speculating and playing with thoughts. Sometimes you might see things.
No, I agree. I think it's good to kind of have your brain be a rubber band that goes out into that expansive potential reality. As long as it comes back as like, okay, well, now that I've played with that idea, what's the reality of it? But I do think that in general, in climate solutions and carbon removal specifically, I like the idea of playing with what's possible. I think, Tito Jankowski of Air Miners talks about that a lot, about like, just imagine what could be possible. And I think that is a positive exercise. Just playing in general, I think can be kind of helpful. Maybe this is self-aggrandizing because we like play a lot in the Nori Meme Lab and we play, we bring humor and we bring kind of some delight into the industry. And so maybe this is self-aggrandizing, but I do think there's a role for bringing in kind of this imagining of what it could be and poking fun at ourselves. Because I think when we poke fun at ourselves, we can sometimes find the true holes in our ideas,
I think engineers, typically they are kind of shy, when it comes to being very creative or, imagining things. They don't, typically they're not the, imagination, people. They, hard math and hard physics and that sort of stuff. And I, personally, I think myself more as kind of an artist. I do play the guitar. I'm not so much an engineer, because I really need to be inspired and I need to be in the right kind of mood and mode, to be able to do something and give my best. And I have a lot of engineering friends that, they just crunch away. And, there's like, they can go from one task to the next one and with, 1 minute orientation period in between. And I'm like,
Well, it's like, could you be farther from my disposition? Probably not. I think we've talked about this on the podcast, though, is I often like going into brainstorming meetings or pitch meetings with the worst idea possible and being the person to throw out the crappiest idea, because then that loosens up other people to throw out the like half-baked idea or quarter-baked idea. And oftentimes the best stuff comes out of someone who's like, this is terrible, but what about this? And you're like, that plus this, boom, we just made something that was great out of nothing, because people felt comfortable sharing an idea that was not really that polished. So yeah, I think creativity can do a lot. And then again, I'm also biased because I want job security, but it's true, I think.
Absolutely. And, I mean, there's a risk of, getting, labeled as the village nutter, more or less, but I, right. I don't shun that, I'm always, if there's a, I like to play with thoughts, it's easy to amuse yourself and your friends, go down these imaginary paths.
Do you have anything like that right now? Something that is really not ready for prime time, but is something that you're thinking a lot about?
Carbon removal related, or you know,
I don't think I need to put that parameter on it. Why don't you just what do you want to share? You clearly have something ready.
Well, my bees did really well last winter, and the honey harvest is looking very good. I'm going to get my cows back in a little bit. You know, they've been away for the winter because I was in California 4 months, and so it's been, you know, a few months away from them now, and I love them dearly. So it's going to be nice to get them back.
You're a farmer too. On top, you do all these things, and then you also farm.
Well, farming is a, you know, source of creativity and kind of recreation, and you know, so it's a kind of a, you know, you got to have a physical exercise, and you got to have, you know, I think I do shooting too. I'm not a gun enthusiast, but I do it for a reason, because I get kind of a feeling of success and achievement, you know, because in my line of work, sometimes you have to work with 10 to 20 years before you actually get anywhere. And, you know, look at me, carbon removal is a thing now, but it wasn't a thing 20 years ago. And so, you know, sometimes, you know, when you hit a steel target, you hear a nice cling back, and my brain is kind of wired, you know, because I used to play, you know, I was in the 80s, and you know, within a lot of video games, so it caused my brain to be wired so that I need that, you know, fairly rapid feedback, and that gives me I figured out why does this feel so good, and you know, because it's like playing a game, instant feedback and instant gratification. So farming too, you know, you get to see things, and you kind of connect to the rhythm of the nature, and you know, it's nice, and then you get feelings of success, and you kind of connect, and it's also good for kind of, you know, quieting down, or cooling off a little bit sometimes too.
Is that how you got into biochar? Did farming go to biochar? Did biochar lead you to farming? Tell us a little bit about your backstory and how you went from somewhere there's farming in there, but then there was the success with CarboFex, and then why you chose to quit biochar basically and pivot into DAC.
A lot of questions. I wasn't the first time I got involved with charcoal was in 1996, or even a few years before. That's when I built, we were one of the largest producers of charcoal in Finland that year when I was in high school, in 1996, yeah. In 1998, I joined the army, so I was out of that for some time. But then I came back, and I started working on gasification from you know, the better part of 2000s, from 2001 till 2000, or yeah, even on from 99 to 2009, more or less. And then I got into pyrolysis, and we came up with the idea of biocoal, which is a kind of an established term today, but it was our trademark back then. And it, you know, the idea was that, you know, you take biomass and you convert it into kind of a drop-in fuel for coal-fired power plants. And, you know, that way, you know, allow to reduce emissions. But that was too windy. And there was the financial crisis. And, you know, it was heavily kind of involved with all these energy schemes, which, you know, you don't really want to be. You want to be an arm's length from, you know, if you want to, you know, build something. And we already knew how to make biochar then, and we had the same machine we used at CarboFex we built in 2009, and we ever since the thought process, like, what are we going to do with biochar so that we could make money or have a business around it? What's the business model going to look like? And in 2015, 2016, we, you know, I had some ideas that were refined, and I saw a few openings, like growing media. You know, we're going to go after perlite, and so then we took the old machine and you know, rigged it up again, and it kind of, you know, refurbished it a little bit. And then we started CarboFex, and that was 2016. And we did pretty good. You know, we did the first methodology for biochar with Puro, and we brought in a lot of, you know, biochar companies to Puro at the time. And, you know, we were also the market leaders in Sweden and pretty much in Europe in biochar. And for a long time, we led the CDR race, or led, or kind of, you know, we're in the top three or top five. Still 4,000 tons, you know, of delivered CDR, you know, today.
So what, you just got sick of success there?
Well, no, actually, you know, it's a tragic story. I didn't leave voluntarily. My founding partner threw me out because we had, he now owned like half of the company. I was down to 27 or something like that. And And it's a long story. I was going to bring in a couple of climate investors, you know, in end of 21, but there was, you know, a late night deal, and ultimately those guys were out, and a few other guys, two other guys were in, and 5 months, 6 months down the line, they're asking me, why are we not selling any machines? I'm like, you know, why are you asking me, why are we not selling machines? We're not supposed to sell any machines. We're developing CDR projects. And you know, that is the way to scale biochar and pyrolysis and CDR in particular. But they had not bought into that plan, you know, that we had, you know, created with the investors that I wanted to have. And basically, you know, it just went downhill from there. You know, there was all kinds of, and in the end, in the end of last summer, we had a, you know, terrible meeting. You know, probably the, you know, we didn't meet up, you know, these guys were, you know, I didn't really even get to know them. It came through the other guy, but the in the end, you know, they wanted to go all into hardware business. They thought that now is the time to sell hardware, and they thought that since we had this, you know, Russian offensive into Ukraine and the energy crisis, you know, it was really, like, you know, big, you know, last summer. So they thought that nobody's going to be interested in the CDR because we've got this crisis. And I was like, well, you know, I don't think so, you know. And then they wanted to go all in into a huge project, you know, that was that we've been trying to make happen for 2-3 years. But we didn't really find a way to make it work for everybody. And the risk would have been on us. And it would have been kind of open book, cost plus 10%, and all the risk on us. I saw what my role would have been, you know, for the next 2-3 years, you know, I couldn't go down that road. So in the end, you know, they fired me, and that was in the end of beginning of August. So it's 10 months almost now. Okay. And they really, you know, didn't think that we were going anywhere, and they didn't think that you know, that is what we should have been doing. And I've seen a lot of, you know, equipment business, and I've seen a lot of projects, and I'm still kind of very, very adamant that, you know, the right way to go is to develop a few projects of your own, and, you know, maybe then 3-4 years down the line, even 2-3, you could sell them to third parties too. But it's good to have a couple of, you know, plants of your own and a solid reference base before, you know, you possibly run into a difficult client or a difficult project. And the sales projects are often difficult because the clients often, you know, they don't use the feedstock that they tell you that they're going to use. And then when it doesn't work, they're going to blame you on it. And then you don't get the money. And then you, you know, end up, you know, going back and forth and trying to fix something, a problem that is not yours. And I've kind of, you know, burned myself out, you know, in that kind of business a long time ago. So my body tells me, you know, don't go there.
Isn't yeah. One of the big bottlenecks for biochar still, there's not a large scale manufacturer of kilns or other devices, right? I've heard people say this. I don't know to what degree it's true, but that is a bottleneck, right?
At the moment, yeah, some of the equipment suppliers are, you know, in short supply. I mean, they can't make enough with those machines, and there's a long lead time, probably could be 2 years with some companies.
I mean, whatever though, if you weren't enjoying your work or the relationships weren't right, or it's just not a vertical you're interested in serving, then I think you're probably better off just moving on and finding something that you are passionate about. And whenever you sell what you're working on now and become fabulously wealthy, and then you move on to fusion, and then you solve that, and then what's next for you, Sampo? Seems like the world is your oyster right now. God, are we just building him up? We've never been so complimentary in the show ever.
Well, I also just appreciate, I appreciate your candor, because yes. I feel like within, you know, here we are on a podcast, and I appreciate your candor, because I think within CDR and climate in general, we don't talk enough about the conflicts that can arise within the startup ecosystem. And I think it is a very supportive sector, like much more than other startups, other founders.
Yeah.
There's a lot of support, but at the same time, you know, I'm part of various different groups where we meet weekly to talk with founders, and the struggles and the conflicts that arise, and the people want to go in different directions. And I just think we don't acknowledge that enough as a community. And so it's great to just hear you speak frankly about your challenges and how you're recovering from them.
Yeah. And I've had to take a little breather after that, because obviously, you know, it was a huge, I put everything, you know, pretty much in on the line, and 6 years, you know, and a lot of my kids grew up in that time. And also, you know, it took financial sacrifices too, you know, initially. So, you know, but yeah, you know, it's an old rule of thumb, you know, you gotta, you know, do what you, you know, like, and, you know, what you're good at. And, you know, if, you know, people don't appreciate your talent, then you take your talent elsewhere and, you know, sell it to somebody else, or, you know, make your own fortune. And well, that's what I've pretty much been doing. I've been an entrepreneur all my life, and you know, I have
no wonder you need to tend to your bees and your cows. I feel like that would be the calming outlet for her high stress climate tech work.
I'm also a, you know, devoted yogi, and I do meditate 2 hours a day, and I'm a vegan. I've been on a vegetarian diet since 1998,
I'm gonna call you out then for your kill two birds with one stone comment, because I learned from I'm a lifelong vegetarian, and my mother would always say, no, Siobhan, you feed two birds with one scone, which has to be the cheesiest, most deplorable turn of phrase for, you know, defying animal cruelty. But I remember it to this day. So whenever someone says that, in my head, I think, feed two birds with one scone.
Yeah, I normally don't use, you know, violent metaphors or you know, things like that, but it's you know, just you know, what I had, you know, at the moment. But yeah.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No. I was just
I was just using it. I was just trying to figure out if it was from the King James Bible or from Shakespeare. That's always the game when there's a weird old idiom. I'm like, which of these two is it from? It's one of the two.
Yeah, Shakespeare is pretty much, you know, everywhere. And I was surprised myself once.
Oh yeah, if you read the King James, like the Gospels, and you read a Hamlet, you're like, cool, this is like 75 of the most commonly used idioms that are still in use.
Yep.
All condensed.
Yeah, he had to, you know, he was good with the word and good with the pen, you know, no doubt.
Okay, now this is outside of the meaning of this podcast, but I'm doing it now.
Yeah, and you know, I'm a kind of collector of phrases, you know, and my friends were, you know, coming up after me at some point, because I was just, you know, using a metaphor, you know, after a metaphor, a phrase after a phrase, and it gets irritating after a little while, you know, because you're just, you know, every time you open your mouth, there's this.
Speaking in metaphors, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, while he's looking for this, how do you fit 2 hours a day of meditation in? Can I ask? Is that CDR adjacent? Should we all be doing 2 hours of meditation as we build our CDR solutions?
Well, my guru tells me that businessmen should do 3 hours of meditation a day, because, you know, the mind is racing, and you should do a 1 hour at midday, or, you know, early afternoon as well, just to, you know, keep the reins. But you do it early in the morning, you do it late in the evening. And, you know, the Buddha said that, you know, the best time to practice your mind is between 4 and 7 in the morning. So, you know, ideally do it then. Or then around 12 o'clock midnight is also good. Unless if you need to be in bed, you can do it earlier.
But, wow, I'm not kidding when I said I was like proud when I got up to 15 minutes. So you're really putting me to shame here.
No, I'm not shaming anybody. You know, the thing is that I had a hard time in sitting 5 minutes initially, and I was breaking sweat, you know, just as soon as the thought of sitting down or doing, you know, asanas or anything like that, you know, it just, you know, immediately I started sweating, and I don't know how it created that kind of reaction in my body, but you know, first you do 5 minutes, you do 10 minutes, and you little by little you grow into it. And after 20 years, you can't eat or sleep if you don't do meditation. So quite often, you know, if I'm late in the morning, it's because I meditated too long. So, you know, it's just hard to let go sometimes.
I was mostly just going to ask, are you, with all of your other ridiculous experiences here and achievements, are you also Simo Haya?
Well, I was the best shooter in my regiment. I still have a golden medal, but that's nothing. I mean, Finnish are typically pretty good, pretty handy with rifles, and most of the males have you know, gone to the military and served some time, and everybody knows how to handle guns. But I'm a competitive shooter. I do cowboy action shooting, so it's kind of a. I've got a.
There are so many layers. I feel like we're peeling back the mineralized carbon layers and finding out more.
You probably don't know this person, Siobhan, but he's like the most celebrated sniper of all time. But in the Winter War against the Soviets during World War II, it was like, I'm just looking at Wikipedia, it's like 500.
Yeah, that was a confirmed count, but you know, the unconfirmed one could be double, you know. That.
Yeah.
He always said that, well, I just did the job that was given to me as good as I could. And, you know, it's, I mean,
matter of fact, Nordic nature.
I have to show you this. I've got a little dent in my finger because I did so much shotgunning last Sunday, and I was shooting at a barrel, and the task was to kind of flip it over, you know, with the shotgun, so that you shoot it once, it kind of go a little bit, and then you have to shoot it again quickly so that it would top over. And I had to do it a lot of times, but that it was a kind of a stage, you know, in cowboy action.
Some cowboy action right there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have two cows, you know, I can actually call myself cowboy.
A true cowboy.
Too bad I don't have my 10-gallon cowboy hat, you know, just, you know, within reach. It's a house rent. I was, you know.
It's too bad.
You need to be friends with Julio Friedman, the Wrangler.
Oh, yeah. I love Julio. He always, you know, for a great show. I commented. I met him in San Jose last winter at the Verge. I like, you know, he's got a, you know, stage charisma. He knows what he's talking about, too. So you have to respect that.
He's the only person I know who has like a dedicated carbon removal persona in that kind of way. I love it. I am the carbon wrangler, and that is who I am. And what is this you're showing?
It's CO2 going down.
Oh, it's being wrangled as we speak. Yeah.
That's when I'm on the phone, that's what you can see, you know, that's the CO2 is being, you know.
Nice. I don't know that this idiom origin story is really that interesting. Sadly, it is not from Shakespeare or King James.
Or the King James. Oh, look at you, Ross. We're going to have to cut this to save face.
That's always my heuristic, though, if I have to guess. I'm just like, boom, it's just guessing
that. Carbon Wrangler is pretty good. You know, you got to, you know, take the bull by the horn. And that's the, you know, proverbial bull, I guess. Mm-hmm.
I was trying to make it sound Shakespearean, and all I came up with, hast thou wrangled thine carbon? But I was like, that's stupid. Cut. Show's done.
I'm waiting for the next carbon removal meme, and you know, see.
We got some good ones.
We'll have to make one for this show. I had some ideas that lit in my brain during this, so I'll make some and tag you.
We're gonna do one on like the co-benefits of DAC and make fun of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Me get you know. Paddling my canoe down the proverbial stream coming out of my DAC plant, and you know, going down to the village, you know, to the farm. You know,
what kind of budgets do you think we're working with over here? What do you think we do? We take a crappy image that's already been used and we stick a sick text on it.
No, that works, you know. Keep doing it. I love it. You know, I laugh out loud sometimes, you know, when I see the carbon removal means.
I'm glad, because sometimes we get notes too that are, well, people will say like, well, these are really quite niche to carbon removal. And they're like, well, yeah, there's plenty of more generic environmental memes pages out there. They don't need more of those. But carbon removal as a community, we need those.
Yeah, I need those. And, you know, it's like, sometimes, you know, I think, you know, really, like when you live and breathe, you know, you know, trade, then, you know, a lot of those things are so, so real to you. And, you know, sometimes it just really hits, you know, the spot. And like I said, I laugh out loud sometimes, and I applaud you, you know.
Oh, thank you. We're going to keep you in mind. This is like become a customer discovery call all of a second. And now we need to, all of a sudden here, figure out how to duplicate this effect.
I'm glad to be able to be complimentary, you know.
Thank you. I'm happy. It's making you laugh. I think that's an important thing to do. Well, wrap. Yeah, we good?
Yeah, let's wrap it up. I think we're good. I think we went all the way from DAC to farming to cowboy shooting. So
Julio makes an appearance. That's always fun. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll take, you know, I'll challenge Julio, you know, to a cowboy shooting match anytime. If he's up for it, you know. Okay.
I think that's beyond the remit of his persona. I don't know that there's a lot of target shooting, obscure target shooting competitions in his daily. But
no, but that's how we dress. That's how we dress when we go to the, you know, cowboy action, you know.
Well, I should hope so. I should hope so.
Thank you so much for listening. If you could please subscribe and give us a great rating and review on Apple Podcasts or a rating on Spotify, that'd be much appreciated. It helps us get our content out to more people. You can sign up for our newsletter at nori.com, follow us on social media, and we will catch you next time.